Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Neely Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Wednesday, January 12, 2011, we have a double feature for you on entrepreneurship. I'm delighted to welcome John Ramey, who is the CEO of iSocket, and on the line with us now, Dave McClure, founding partner of 500 Startups. Thanks for making time to join us.
Thanks for having us. Good morning.
Good morning. So it looks like we have John, actually, you're very popular, Dave, so we should probably dive right into it. Looks like people are calling in already. If you have a question for Dave, go ahead and tweet in if you can or email directly. Dave, obviously, you're a very well-known figure in the Valley. I love that you said that you've been geeking out for 20 years. So tell me where, this show, we really want to get people's heads around how to become entrepreneurs. And I met John actually at a San Francisco Blog Club meeting, which is a new group, and, started talking to me about iSocket. And I thought, God, what, a great example of American entrepreneurship. Here he's so young, he's already founded 3 companies, and I'd love to hear how you started, kind of where you started the geeking out process.
Well, I guess I started out the geeking process as a geek. I was originally a programmer, database engineer back in, the late 80s, early 90s. And
what kind of engineer were you? I love asking that question.
What kind of engineer? Nerdy?
No, I don't mean in terms of personality type. What did you code?
Well, I'm probably way over the hill, but I was working on SQL Server and Sybase on the back end and a variety of different Windows-based
front ends. Very cool.
But I think I'm kind of dating myself. It's almost like admitting to programming in COBOL.
Yeah, I think people are really going to think ill of you now, Dave. Now, come on. Okay, so started out as a coder or
yep.
programmer, and then you moved on. What was the next step?
Well, gradually started a small consulting business doing originally database consulting, but then later internet and intranet and e-commerce projects, and kind of switched over from engineering to managing projects to kind of running the business. And before I knew it, I was incompetent as a programmer, and all of a sudden I was an entrepreneur. and I think
so it's thrust upon you.
Yeah, well, you kind of realize as you're getting into it, sort of what the role requires of you. And I think pretty quickly it became I was running the business more than doing the coding. And actually, I enjoyed that. I liked coding a lot, but I also found it very creative in helping get a business started. Although I think the first business that I ran, I really learned a lot about what it takes to run a business. And sometimes you learn a lot about yourself in the process.
Interesting. That's a very good observation. So from there, I guess the question on everybody's minds, and at least I'm going to ask the obvious question, how did you get the money to be able to fund other people's ventures?
Well,
and you don't have to answer that too specifically. Be effusive if you like. I just have to ask.
That's fine. So the first business that I ran was a relatively small success. We had, we got acquired in 98, and I made a little bit of money out of that. And pretty much just continued trying to do different startups and be involved with them. In 2001, I had the opportunity to join PayPal and ended up working there for 3 years, starting and running their developer program. Ended up making a little bit of money at PayPal, and that was really kind of the beginning of when I started doing angel investing.
Interesting. So do you consider yourself an angel investor now?
Well, now I'm running a fund, so
now you're a VC.
Yeah, I guess the difference is whether you're managing, funds for other people versus investing your own money. So as an angel investor, I did about 13 investments, so about $300,000 in 13 companies, and a few others I was an advisor for. And now running a fund, well, I'm also one of the investors in the fund, and there are several other people that I'm kind of coordinating and managing their funds and investments.
So now you, one of the things that came up in your bio is that you have said that your passion is helping startups with product and marketing strategy. And I'm curious where that kind of came from. You know, where was the genesis of sort of the business side of things? I mean, you said that, you know, that you kind of explained a little bit of that, but I'd love for you to go a little bit deeper about other people's companies and how that becomes a passion for you.
Sure. Well, I guess it kind of came out of the work that I was doing. So as a programmer and then later kind of managing projects and even later working at PayPal where I was on more of the marketing evangelism side, a lot of things that I was doing in addition to coding were kind of figuring out what, you know, customers wanted and how you design, you know, products and then also how you market them. Particularly at PayPal, I guess, spent a fair amount of time working on a bunch of different new, at least at the time, new marketing techniques. So search engine marketing and search engine optimization. I know it sounds a little bit dated at this point, but even email newsletters and then blogging and other social media. So a lot of those 3 years I spent sort of helping build and evangelize products on PayPal's platform to other merchants and developers. But I also was at the same time learning a lot about new marketing techniques that were taking advantage of search and social and online platforms. And I guess that's probably a little bit unusual career path or transition from someone in engineering to end up on the marketing side.
Yeah, it is a little bit.
But I think what it sort of gave some insight was kind of now how a lot of internet companies, I think the internet companies are successful as much based on kind of the design and distribution kind of parts of the business as the engineering part. So I think having had some background on both the engineering side and on the marketing side gave me an appreciation for what it takes to build a business in those different skill sets.
Fabulous. We'll be joined shortly by one of the companies that you've kind of inadvertently invested in. But if just while I have you, 500 Startups, tell us about that so people know exactly what it is because, you know, I know those of us that follow you on Facebook or on Twitter or whatever will see you jetting off here, there, wherever. And I think you're doing with students some of the time. So can you explain what it is?
Sure. 500 Startups is a venture capital fund. We started it last year. Previously, I'd been managing early stage investments for Founders Fund and also running the Facebook Incubator Program for Founders Fund and Excel. And a lot of the ideas we had been, you know, playing around with and investing in for those two funds sort of became the genesis of what we're doing now. So a little bit different than most other funds, we, you know, tend to emphasize approach that's based on not just technical founders, but also design and distribution. So our tagline is kind of blowing up startups with design, data, and distribution. And then the major difference is that we're really investing in a very large number of startups, relatively small checks, but we're probably aiming to do about 75 to 100 investments per year. About half of those initially at incubation stage and half at seed stage. And then, you know, we do expect to follow on investments at Series A and B with the companies that are succeeding, but we're probably a minority investor in other larger seed funds or venture capital funds are also likely to be investors at those stages. And then I guess you mentioned travel a lot. That's not necessarily the focus of what we do, but we do have a little bit more outside the valley approach than other investment. Probably about two-thirds of our investments are in the San Francisco Bay Area, but another 10 to 20% are in the rest of the U.S., and another 10 to 20% are outside the country in Asia and Europe. So we spend a little bit more time on the road, or I spend a little bit more time on the road than the average Silicon Valley VC, I guess.
Yeah, that's always a really exciting thing. I think I saw something that you'd written in, I know my sister, brother-in-law, and my two nephews spent some time in Shanghai, which was a great experience for the boys. Unfortunately, not as great, I think, an experience for my sister-in-law. But I guess when you're at a certain level, you know, you're supposed to name your drivers. And I remember thinking, well, what a great opportunity to actually learn how to say people's names. You know, why would you name your driver John so that, you know, you can pretend that it's all like, you know, they're English, but, you know, all like this just, you know, Western melting pot. And so I kind of challenged her to that. And I think, you know, it's always nice to have a broadened world view. It can always be broader. But that I would imagine is part of something that is unique to you.
Yeah, well, I guess for me, it sort of came out of personal connection through family. My wife's Japanese, and her family is over there. And I started to get to know some folks in Tokyo and had always wanted to travel a little bit more, and I didn't really get to do as much traveling when I was younger. And so 2 years back, we started a program called Geeks on a Plane, which is kind of a travel and cultural exchange opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors. And we've done a couple of trips in Asia and Europe, I guess we're planning some trips now also to South America and probably India later in the year. And that was a really great experience. So I got to, you know, meet with a bunch of different startups and investors in different parts of the world. And particularly, I guess, you know, my connection to Japan and then kind of learning more about China, just the fascinating amount of growth and technology and innovation happening in Asia right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, especially in, I know I've worked on BRICS strategies before. It's just the sheer number of people, if you realize outside the United States or outside Western countries, how many more, you know, the opportunity for markets outside the U.S. is just insane, you know. And I mean, there's just, and it's a lot of times it's, you can make money off basic needs. And when I say make money off of, I mean, you know, in a way that's beneficial on both sides. So it can be a really positive thing. Let's see if we can get John Rainey on the line. John, is that you there waiting for us?
Hey, I'm here.
Hey, welcome to the program. We're live here. John is the CEO of iSocket, which, as he so eloquently puts it, tries to make online advertising not suck. Is that right?
Suck less.
Suck less. Sorry.
It's always going to suck a little bit. We just make it, we minimize the suck.
And so the connection here is that inadvertently, Dave McClure is one of your investors. So do you want to talk a little bit for the audience who doesn't know what the connection is on your end between the two of you?
Sure, absolutely. Why is Dave, hey Dave, as Dave's been talking about, he now runs his own fund called 500 Startups. Before that, he was working with Founders Fund, and they were doing a seed program. Dave has worked with a couple different vehicles like Founders Fund and Facebook. And while he was with Founders Fund, they had an angel seed program, which was a little bit before his current fund got started. We were putting a seed round together. I had gotten to know Dave a couple times. I attended his awesome events, Startup to Startup, Finance for Founders. Had a lot of love and respect. He and Jeff Clavier, I was excited to have both of them in the round, and we were honored that they wanted to participate. So that's how it worked.
Fantastic. That's the most simple explanation of exactly the genesis of it all that I think I've ever heard. So I applaud you for that. So in terms of having Dave on board, do you, you know, from your perspective, and Dave, feel free to chime in, do you feel like you can, you know, what is the relationship like between you as an entrepreneur and he as someone who's providing funds for you or has?
Well, it varies with each investor. I've found that one of the key differences in the how the interaction will work is whether or not, or what the background of the investor is. Have they been an operator, which Dave has absolutely been? Have they not been an operator? Guys who have been operators tend to understand more of the minutiae and what's happening inside the startup that you don't necessarily have to cover, or they can sympathize with, or they can help you navigate through. Whereas people who have different backgrounds can help you with different areas of advice, like more financial or projections-based if they had an iBanking background. Dave is very unique in his background with what he talked about, with kind of that combination of marketing and tech and engineering. Obviously, he's got his startup metrics for Pirates talk. We use it internally. A lot of others do. It's kind of shaped a lot of this current focus, and a good focus on design and acquisition funnels, because it's not enough just to build a product. You have to distribute it well, and that can often be the key, because there can be 10 different products that do the same thing. Will yours be the one that grows and stands out? And Dave's very unique in his ability as an investor to kind of come in and poke at you and help you guide that process.
So, Dave, I think that's a good point for you to talk about what the sort of lean startup metrics are that you have talked about sort of within the realm of entrepreneurship. But part of when we talk about entrepreneurship on this show, I like to kind of get beyond sort of the industry speak and try to speak at a level so that everyone can feel empowered to take part. So maybe you can kind of pop up a level and kind of explain what that general emphasis on metrics means.
Sure. So I guess the term you mentioned, lean startup, is one that was popularized by Eric Ries. Eric is a great entrepreneur who has been a founding CTO at a company called InView. And I guess before that, Eric had been in different roles in a couple of different companies, and a lot of his experiences in both succeeding and not succeeding in building startups shaped his philosophies around how to help, you know, make startups better and build them better. There's a series of talks that John mentioned that I do called Startup Metrics for Pirates, which also came out of some experiences I've had at PayPal and Simply Hired and Mint.com, again, around how to think about ways to build startups better, more specifically about how to measure success in ways that allow you to, you know, allocate resources better. So both of those philosophies, Lean Startup and Startup Metrics for Pirates, really come from, I guess, thinking about progress not measured in just working on code and features, but really accomplishing user goals and objectives, sometimes business goals also. And a lot of times, you know, the classic Silicon Valley startup is kind of this, you know, two geeks in a garage coding away. But I think the, you know, the ideas that, you know, Eric and I have tried to popularize really came out of some work that Steve Blank had done in a book called Four Steps to Epiphany. And most of that is just really getting out of the building, as Steve likes to say, and talking to customers. And then trying to build the minimal possible solution that satisfies customer needs, and not, you know, overbuilding or really going beyond the point of satisfying initial customer requirement to solve a problem. And that sort of sounds very basic and, you know, pretty straightforward, but you'd be surprised how many people really don't get out and talk to, you know, their customers and really understand more about how their product is being used by people. And at the same time, I think, you know, trying to understand a little bit more analytical and numerical way to look at marketing, trying to combine both of those approaches and really build a culture of feedback in your development process.
Absolutely.
So much linear, but really taking and measuring what's going on with customers and then using that to drive decisions.
So one question that comes up a lot in our shows is, you know, if you don't have the user base and you don't want to necessarily buy traffic, let's say, and for those that don't know, buying traffic would be sort of, you know, there's different advertising approaches, there's different ways that you can sort of, you know, make sure that you get customers. But instead of acquiring customers who want to use your product or, you know, stumble upon it as a solution to your needs. So how do you look at sort of the user acquisition? I mean, at what point do you feel like you have enough of a base, or is there a secret to building the base to even get to the point where you feel like feedback is useful?
Well, I think, you know, there's lots of different ways to acquire customers, but actually I don't really think in the beginning you need a whole lot of customers to make reasonable decisions about product and marketing. Very often you can acquire, you know, 10 to 100 customers through, you know, either just blogging and writing about your product, doing user interviews. I don't necessarily think paid traffic or acquired customers via paid methods is such a bad thing, at least in the beginning stages of learning about your business. And pretty much on, you know, relatively limited budget, you know, whether you acquire customers for free or on a paid basis, you can probably get 10 to, you know, 20 qualitative interactions with customers, maybe even up to 20 to 100 sort of online, that drive enough, you know, data for you to make interesting, you know, conclusions about how your product is working. So in the early stages of the company, while you're still trying to work out what type of solution you're building and what customer base you're developing that for, having a large number of customers and really coming up with an acquisition strategy isn't the most important thing. Really building a useful product is, and then working on the user experience.
Oh, absolutely. I can concur with that. Having done, you know, some web strategy and marketing in my time, you know, it gets to the point where if you're lucky enough, you get to turn down the stuff that you just don't think is going to go anywhere. But unfortunately, the passion projects are the things that keep you at work really late at night, trying to figure out how you're going to get the word out about something that may not be the most, because it's new, you know, it's disruptive. And if you don't get the advantage of TechCrunch Disrupt notoriety, you know, what do you do? So I think that's a great lesson. Whatever users you do have, you should be leveraging them for feedback in a brand advocacy sort of manner.
You know,
yeah,
I can add on
I guess
to,
the point. Sorry, go ahead, John.
Well, I was going to say I could add on to show practically how, you know, we're doing exactly what Dave is saying.
Perfect.
Now, it is important to see how this applies to different types of products. A lot of the general lean startup type stuff and what Dave talks about applies a little bit more so to consumer products, in my opinion. We're not a consumer product, and we have a paywall. So that alters things a little bit, but the principle is the same. When you're in this early stage of a company, you need to first figure out your machines. You need to figure out your loops and your processes and what works and what doesn't. We were in a period for quite a while where we were not focused on growth. We were focused on getting our product and processes to a point that made sense. So we actually had a guy who was a very talented marketing guy. He joined our team, and his title is Customer BFF. I think, Jennifer, you met him at the blog meetup.
Yes, I did. He threw a T-shirt at me, absolutely.
So he's this fun marketing social guy. He built a community, a very large 25 million unique a month community at HubPages. He was the first hire that I made at iSocket. His title is Customer BFF. And sometimes it's a support role, like a customer support role, but what it essentially is he's the guy who is the best friend with our customers. And while we were in that period that was a small, limited kind of customer testing, learning beta phase, he had a relationship with every single one of them, and not only did it allow us to build a good brand and build a good relationship with our customer, the amount that we learned from it was unbelievable. So what Dave was saying about just even with 20 customers, 50 customers, get out there and talk to them and learn what you need to learn so that you can put your foot on the right gas pedals, we did that even inadvertently via this title and this role that we have.
So one of the questions that's coming in right now is actually how you're reaching those customers. So is it email? Is it Twitter? Is it something else that, you know, is, you know, people have said, you know, Dave is known for the Facebook class back in, I think, 2007. Is it Facebook? What is it that for your business, John, has been the best way for your, basically your customer advocate, that BFF, to be out there engaging?
Well, you know, there's no golden bullet for any business, and it totally depends on your business. So what might work by paid search for one business could be a complete money waster for another business. And you hear stories like that where there's one very popular Valley startup that just completely stopped doing paid search marketing because they found that for every $100 they would spend, they'd make 40. So it depends. You know, it varies based on your business. If you have a very, like if you're Instagram, Twitter, right? That's how. Twitter is less important for my business, again, because it's not a necessarily a social loop product. What we have found works for us at this stage, is, believe it or not, is still hand-to-hand. What we're doing is very, what you would call consultative sales. It's not a long sales process, but it's typically people have so many questions because they're so used to the old way of doing things. We kind of showed up and said, hey, you don't have to be stuck where it sucks anymore. Come do it this way. And usually there's about 15 minutes of questions just for them to come to terms with the fact that, oh, wow, it can actually work this way, and then they sign up. So we actually found, for example, that we put a live chat widget on our site. So if you go to isocket.com, during normal business hours, you'll see that it says talk to a real live human. And that sounds and feels kind of corporate-y. Like when we were talking about doing that inside our team, all of us kind of winced and said, that really sucks, we don't want to do that. But we have found it's amazing. And that would not work for many other businesses, but it's worked for ours. So it depends. You just have to look at, when I spend $3, do I get more than $3 or less than $3? Figure out those loops. We've tested marketing funnels that don't work for us, and we've tested ones that do. And you need to go through those experiments in a time while you're still small and not burning a lot of money, so that when you've found the right ones that work, you can, you know, press your foot on that gas pedal.
So which have you found that, you know, in terms of communication at least, that work well for you? Because I know that, you know, there are some companies where forums work really well. And I know for the average marketer anyway, you know, forums can be a nightmare. They just don't know what to do. They don't know how to become an insider or how to add value to conversation, or they may not have the concept of adding value in the first place. So just in terms of general rules of thumb when it comes to communicating with customers in a way that is mutually beneficial, both Dave and John, you know, would love to hear what your thoughts are on that.
You can't fake it. And this applies to almost any standard kind of startup question you hear. How do you raise money? How do you get customers? How do you market? How do you be a part of a forum? People focus too much on the tactic and not enough on, do I actually have something genuine here? There shouldn't be really any fear about being a part of a community or a part of a forum if you just are genuine. Is it a topic that you care about? You don't have to be an expert in it. Even just being there to raise your hand and say, hey, I agree with this, that's part of being in the community. So if you kind of strip away the ulterior motives and you strip away the strategy and the kind of the politics of it, just be genuine. You know, be nice to people, be genuine, be a part of the community in that specific instance with forums. But as it relates to almost anything or any standard startup question, strip away the bull, strip away the quote-unquote politics of it, be genuine, and if you are genuine, you'll be rewarded for it.
Dave, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think you know, most of my initial experiences in doing community marketing happened when I was at PayPal, probably under fire for a lot of customers who were, you know, either having challenges or difficulties learning about PayPal or complaining about something that, you know, didn't go the way they expected. And I would agree with John that sometimes being just authentic is, you know, adds a lot of credibility. The other thing I would mention is usually education helps. So certainly being part of the community is really important, but if you want to, you know, get a position of some, you know, influence or authority in the community, usually that comes from an area of expertise or education that you can help other people with. So a lot of what I was trying to do with PayPal was educate people about how to, you know, accept credit cards and build online shopping cart and payment button solutions for their products and services. And I've really found that that's kind of most of what I like to do on the marketing side is really coming from an education foundation. And, you know, sometimes you're educating people about your product. Sometimes you're educating them about, you know, the general market and solution that you're operating within. But in either case, I think if you're trying to help them solve problems and, you know, explain some things that might, you know, make their lives better, usually that helps build trust. And then, you know, hopefully that's a position from which you can then explain more about the products and services that you're offering are.
Very, very good insight. So let's, I want to make sure that we get John to be able to kind of do sort of a virtual pitch of what his company is. So can you tell us what the elevator pitch is, John, for your company?
Sure. Well, you said it earlier. iSocket really are the reason this company exists is to make the process of buying and selling advertising suck less. When it comes to direct sales for advertising, as opposed to ad networks or Google-style stuff, I'm a website. I want to sell advertising directly to you. That's a very hand-to-hand process. It takes a lot of time, emails back and forth, logistics, blah. Our product takes those painful parts and makes them very easy. So TechCrunch, for example, was our first publisher. If you wanted to advertise your podcast with a banner ad on TechCrunch, before iSocket, you would have had to go through this two-week-long back-and-forth pain in the ass. With us, you can go to TechCrunch, click Advertise, see the different packages that they've put together, pick the ones that you want, do the date scheduling, pick your impressions, upload your creative, and you're done. TechCrunch gets an email saying, congratulations, you sold an ad. They can see who bought it, what it looks like, and they click approve or reject. If they click approve, we take care of all the painful parts. Payment processing, ad serving, metrics, yield management, scheduling, invoicing, etc. It's a commission-free product. We were the first in the industry to do that. We charge a low monthly SaaS fee to publishers. So, for example, if you are a website with 5 million impressions per month, it's $99. We don't keep a cut of the advertising money that you make. So we're saving publishers a ton of money compared to others. We're making some publishers a ton of money with direct sales as opposed to ad networks. So it's really about the publisher kind of wanting to stand on their own 2 feet, sell their advertising the way that they want to, directly to their advertisers, and we make that process as painless as possible.
Seems like, you know, that's really ideal, but what do you do if you have a fragmented distribution network? So, you know, and maybe there isn't a solution for this, but I know, like, for example, in my case, so with podcasts, in the podcasting community, we get syndicated. And, you know, I get metric reports back, you know, iTunes is not the best, but eventually I get them. And I will sometimes be shocked at how many, usually more than not, especially on book tours, I'm shocked at how many listens we've actually had, but I'm reporting on that really later, or I don't really necessarily have a way to sort of package that. Do you have a way to help publishers figure out the packaging process? Because it seems like that is something that would be difficult. And what do you do if, or can you help those that have kind of a fragmented distribution structure where their syndication is absolutely key?
Now, are you referring to how do you help a publisher where their content is fragmented, like how your podcast kind of lives in different places across the web?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously Blog Talk Radio, God bless Alan Levy, is, you know, the person who founded the platform on which this is based. But the most listens happen on iTunes. There's other platforms like Blueberry and others that syndicate the content. And then, of course, there's viral widgets, which, you know, it helps that those are coded back to Blog Talk Radio. So I get some sense of,
sure,
you know, people picking up that widget. But you know, I mean, this basically multimedia, and which is where I come from, whether it's video or audio, kind of lives in this content distribution, not a non-web-centric or a non-single entity kind of place. So I think you get that part. So is there an answer for folks like us or you know, obviously bigger companies?
There's an answer. It's not as clean cut as there is an answer for iSocket to websites. When you're selling advertising, whether it's premium direct sales like what we do or even remnant ad network stuff, when you're selling advertising, you're selling a product, and that product is boxes of your customers. So you're literally taking boxes, putting your customers in it, and putting a price tag on it. So in order to sell that to an advertiser, the advertising has to go wherever your content goes. So if your podcast kind of lives out across the web, the best way to do that would be advertising that's embedded in the podcast so that it can travel with the content. So it might be, you know, pre-rolls or sponsorships like what Mixergy does. It's a tough problem, and I know a lot of people that face it. I advise a video site that gets millions of views for their produced in-house content, but they get it on Daily Motion and YouTube. And they try to drive that traffic back to their website, but they can't, well, because it's the nature of the content. People want to consume it while they're watching a stream about that topic on, you know, Metacafe. So the best thing to do is to put the advertising with your content, you know, and that's what websites do. It's just a little bit easier because TechCrunch's content is on TechCrunch, or it's in RSS, or it's in email, and that's where they put their ads. In terms of solutions or products, there's been attempts at it. Like, I think there was a company called Kiptronic. People have taken a stab at helping to monetize podcasts, helping to monetize videos, email lists, Twitter lists. They typically don't take hold. It involves a lot of hand-to-hand sales, kind of going out and drumming up the advertisers yourself, and then doing all the backroom, man-behind-the-curtain stuff yourself. So you can call up an advertiser and say, hey,
I don't mean so specifically to call out myself necessarily either. I mean, I'm talking sort of generally. You know, one of the things that I passionately talk to a lot of people about, especially, you know, entrepreneurs or companies in stealth that have very charismatic leaders, is, you know, get yourself on YouTube or get yourself on, you know, YouTube, but use, you know, TubeMogul or somebody else to syndicate. And so, of course, being metric-driven, and we want to see how that message resonates, the question is then how do you get the metrics and kind of pull those all together? So whether it's trying to find money or whether it's actually trying to get metrics for, you know, whether a personality is going to resonate and help you build your user base, seems like it's still the same potential issue.
Well, the shorter answer is it depends on where you want to go distribute. The key thing when it comes to metrics is to focus on the right metrics. Like, if you're distributing video, it's easy to look at the number of video views that you've had, and as that number goes up, you feel better and you get all excited. But if that doesn't translate into anything good for you, then it doesn't matter, and it's what Eric and Dave and all that group call vanity metrics. So whatever you're doing, if you're trying to measure something, make sure you're measuring the right thing.
And also little things too, like if you can, you know, what the actual, if people, you know, how much of whatever the piece of multimedia content is, how much people actually listen to. So the further you can drill down in the metrics, the better, you know, in terms of location. Dave, anything to add sort of on that front as we get into a increasingly fragmented content world?
Well, I don't know that I have specific suggestions around, you know, fragmented distribution base. But one thing I would say is when you're trying to measure customer activity on different channels is understanding what action users are converting to, if that's possible. And like John was saying, really understanding kind of how that creates value for the business. I think the other recommendation I might have is just not to get too caught up in different measurement tools and techniques and really simplify the process as much as you can down to maybe just two or three critical things that matter. So, you know, if you're a consumer web-driven business, understanding how many people come to your website, what clicks or actions they take, and is there a purchase funnel or other monetization activity, and then maybe understanding some, you know, retention and referral metrics. But I wouldn't try and get too complicated. I think it's very easy for people to get caught up in the tools and different numbers, and that kind of distracts from understanding how you make decisions. So really just looking at very specific and simple things like, you know, a conversion percentage from visitors to the page to, you know, providing an email address, or how people convert through a purchase funnel, and then trying to optimize either the product features or optimize the marketing to make improvements.
Excellent.
Yeah, agreed.
So Dave, I know we don't have much more time with you because you've got to run. So I want to ask you, because a lot of people learned your name through the kind of infamous, at this point, Stanford course on Facebook applications. I don't know if maybe you can spend a minute explaining what that was, but it was a real eye-opener to a lot of us who got to come to the event afterwards, where each of the people that had been part of the class actually presented what kinds of applications they had created in Facebook and what the results were. It seemed like a really actual activity where you learned something at Stanford, and you were part of at least the first course. So wanted to just ask you about that.
Sure. Well, I guess, you know, the basics of it, we were trying to teach Stanford students about how to design social applications for the Facebook platform. And it was pretty early after Facebook platform had launched. I believe it was fall of 2007, a little over 3 years ago. And at the time, I guess it was fortunate, Facebook had a relatively loose distribution policy around applications, which they've subsequently tightened up quite a bit. So we benefited from having an environment where it was relatively easy to acquire users on Facebook. Now I think it's a little bit more challenging, although it's still possible. The thrust of what we were doing, though, was instead of having people read about business cases and that kind of stuff, is really to more do it firsthand and build applications and learn themselves. And so Facebook was a great environment at the time to build relatively simple and lightweight applications where people could learn about the process of development and process of acquiring customers in a social platform, and then using, you know, whatever measured techniques we had to iterate and develop those businesses further. What was surprising about that experience was that of the 25 teams or so that we had in the class, five or six of them were very successful, at least on, you know, acquiring user bases, and developed apps or widgets that attracted over 1 million users for their application. And as a result of that, they were able to, mostly on an advertising basis, make some amount of money in the class. And one of the teams actually got venture funding. So I think we were probably most famous for causing a few students to drop out of Stanford. Several of them, a few of them sold their applications to other businesses. A few of them joined companies like Rocky or Slide. And then one team actually raised venture capital from Ron Conway and Mike Maples and started a business which is now called ShareThrough, and they're doing a service providing social media branding and optimization for larger companies in entertainment, in the entertainment industry.
Interesting. So it always struck me that it was you and DJ Fogg, who was the coach. I guess you taught the class together, I believe.
Yep.
Absolutely. So you guys had very different approaches afterwards. So I don't. Did you continue teaching at all? I know BJ is still at Stanford, if I'm not mistaken. But
yeah.
You know, you're very different personalities. Kind of, how were the roles differentiated in that course in terms of teaching it?
Well, I think BJ has been teaching at Stanford for a while. That was really my first teaching experience. And he's been working on a lot of behavioral psychology techniques in technology and something called the Persuasive Laboratory over there and Persuasive Technology Lab. And a lot of his research has been on how, you know, technology and social applications are, you know, causing change in society, some of that in business areas and some of that in other, you know, social activism areas.
Mm-hmm.
So he's, you know, continued to do a lot of that research and continues to teach in different areas. For me, it was really an opportunity to learn more about how, you know, Facebook was an interesting platform, and then subsequently other companies that also were doing interesting, you know, technology around social media, such as Twitter and YouTube as well. So my, you know, subsequent kind of efforts were more around the investing and entrepreneurship areas, more specifically. But I think we were, you know, very complimentary in that particular time. And, you know, we weren't the only people that were really helping teach that class. We brought in a number of other entrepreneurs and investors mm-hmm. and people working at different companies in the Facebook ecosystem to help with that.
Fantastic. So now you have another young entrepreneur here in John who dropped out of school because he jumped into the school of life. More beneficially. Any thoughts about that, Dave, before we kind of let you go? And John, you're welcome to feel free to ask Dave a question as well before he has to go.
How are you doing, Dave?
I'm doing great. yeah, I think the dropout thing is maybe a little bit overemphasized. And
yeah.
You know, probably the piece of well, I don't mean that in a bad way. I think, you know, John found an opportunity to get started with some business that I think really made a difference. But I think the point that I would make is that really schools, at least colleges and you know, graduate schools, aren't always the best environment for learning about entrepreneurship. And really,
oh, amen.
Well, I mean, no, sometimes they can be. I mean, they're great for, you know, specific areas of discipline in, you know, engineering or science or in other cases marketing, but I think a lot of the techniques have been changing so fast in the internet and the web that really it's been difficult for schools to keep up with that. And so a lot of times the best training and experiences are really happening in industry and happening from people actually doing startups. So I think having, you know, some theory-based approaches to learning is important, but having a more experiential and kind of hands-on approach to a lot of these new platforms is probably more beneficial than waiting for sort of academic curriculum to catch up. So I think that's why we, you know, we're trying to have a more interactive, you know, class that was involving, you know, people from industry and technology, and a curriculum that I would say wasn't actually quite fully formed when we got started with it. And, you know, failing that, even just getting out of the classroom and getting started with building actual businesses and products and using that as the learning experience, not so much reading about other people's experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I've stayed in touch with some of the people because I went to, I think, every booth. I was one of the last people to leave that because I just thought it was one of the other things was just opening it up to the public at the end and allowing students to present to just sort of whoever showed up. That was a fantastic experience. I'd never experienced it at graduate school or at undergraduate, at the undergraduate level where, you know, you were able to, you know, not only see their presentation, but then interact with them afterwards and see, you know, kind of where they were in the process of thinking about, you know, partnership or, you know, the value of their product or whatever the question might have been. It was such an amazing, you guys were just spot on in terms of timing. So whoever thought to put the class together at the time that you guys did a fabulous job with that. So I don't think that can be underestimated at all.
Well, thank you. I think we were very fortunate to be at a particular time in history when that was possible. So I won't take too much credit for that. But one of the things I think is great is that there was a subsequent class that came right after us that was doing a similar thing around building applications for the iPhone that I think one of the founders of Tapulous was involved with, and it seems like now there's more, you know, classes at Stanford that are trying to involve building products and launching them in the wild, less about sort of just reading business case studies.
That's a positive trend.
Yeah, and credit
even
to Stanford for
school.
Being an awesome place to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's really one of the more innovative places to think about that, and it's not always easy to kind of get classes approved whenever your curriculum isn't always set in stone.
I just want to quickly recommend too for those that are having legal questions in this area, Ryan Kalo, who's a research fellow kind of following Lauren Slesig's steps now that he's at Harvard, is doing amazing work trying to figure out some of the legal issues and ramifications of all this really agile change. But Dave, I know that you need to move on, and I really appreciate you joining us. John will stay on with us, and we can focus more on his product. But thank you so much for being part of the A-List.
Thanks a lot. I hope you guys have a great day.
See you, Dave.
Thanks. You too. Take care, Dave. And that was Dave McClure from 500 Startups. And so, John, we're going to focus a little bit more on eye contact, which should make you super happy. So we talked about what EyeSocket does, because it has this beautifully simple concept that I think was a long time coming for, you know, especially when you look at things like, you know, and go on my platform, you know, I'm out of adjectives today. I'm so sorry. It's not even 11 yet. But you know, my soapbox, I guess, for lack of a better term, and say, you know, there's all these bloggers and others that have become publishers. You know, you look at someone like Mike Arrington, who founded TechCrunch, which has since been acquired. And, you know, he was a lawyer by trade. He wasn't a journalist. I went to Columbia School of Journalism, so I have mixed feelings about that, as lots of people know, and but don't begrudge good information, quality information coming from any source, which means that you've empowered a lot of people to make money off of good content, which is, you know, ultimately what everyone wants to see happen. So would love to hear about more, you know, more of the companies that you're working with that are kind of along those lines, maybe companies others haven't heard of, so they get some mention out there in cyberspace.
Sure, sure. I completely agree with the high-level point, though, of if we can help content producers, especially the premier content producers who deserve it, if we can help them survive, that's wonderful. I mean, it's also double-sided, though, because there's the advertisers that support them, and there needs to be value for them, too. You know, our goal is not to make publishers tons of money. That happens by way of letting two people get together and do a deal well, because for every publisher that is making great money, they deserve to, because the advertisers are getting value from them. Now, focusing back on the publishers, there's some experiments or some little tests that we've been running that I can't specifically point to, but they all represent publishers who might not have been able to stand on their own. Either they were not making any money at all, or they were relying, or rather stuck with something like Google AdSense, and it wasn't enough to pay the bills or to justify more time or them leaving their full-time job. With direct sales, we've been able to help them do that. They're able to take control of their business. They're able to have kind of build long-lasting relationships with advertisers, and they're able to make the type of money that they should be making. Because the proportion between dollars that you make, well, like in the ad business, there was a famous kind of quote a couple years ago where they said, we're trading analog dollars for digital pennies, because as this content was going online, they were getting paid less proportionally. So somebody might be producing wonderful, wonderful content that takes investment on their part to make, and they'll make 10 cents for it. And there's something out of whack there. So if we can help equalize that and help people that want to produce good content and contribute, and they're able to be rewarded for that so that they can continue to do so, that's awesome. Somebody specific that I would point to, one of our newer publishers is one of the largest fashion and beauty websites on the web. They're called lookbook.nu. Huge site, huge traffic, very loyal fan base. You know, and they were, it's a couple people, and we've been able to help them kind of succeed in this regard. And you can point to almost any publisher on our network, both the big ones like the Cheeseburger Network, TechCrunch, and Lookbook, all the way down through little hyper-local sites where it's one person writing on the weekend who wanted to generate money from their content and they donate it to charity. Anything in between, we've been able to help, and that's really awesome for us.
Absolutely. So we should repeat the URL in case it's so hard between M's and N's to hear the difference. So it's lookbook, all one word, dot N as in Nancy, U as in universe.
That's right,
so,
lookbook.nu.
And if you search, so much search is contextual now, but you should be able to just, if you're in North America, search lookbook. It's a very, very well-known site, and it does what its goal is accomplished quite well for those of us that love fashion. So you should definitely take a look at it if you're interested. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's a great story, but I think I'm going to revert to what we talked about when we met at the San Francisco Blogging Club, which is, you know, the fact that you're young and you left school and because you found that you were able to accomplish life goals without necessarily needing a formalized education. So this is actually your third, well, fully, you know, I know you're pretty close to graduation. So, but this is already your third startup, and I think that this is, you know, my prediction, or one of mine, I guess, as time goes on. I don't know if it's a 2011 prediction or just a prediction as we move on in life, is that, you know, we'll find that there's, you know, there are going to be cases where we need formalized education and cases where they're just people that are so bright, they're out there contributing, and maybe they go back to school later, or maybe they don't need to, this life of their school. But this is you're in your early 20s. This is already your third startup. Do you want to talk about your journey? Because we only have a few minutes left, but I think that that's worth telling because there may be people that are in school, have a fabulous idea, and maybe you can help them figure out the litmus test of, do I really leave school or do I stick around a bit longer?
Sure, and I'm glad you brought that up because the whole school versus not school versus dropping out thing, I think can be misguided sometimes. You know, I've given talks at conferences where people have kind of positioned it as, see, this is proof that you should drop out of school because school sucks. And I disagree with that blanket statement. It depends on what you want to do. If you want to be an engineer, go to an amazing school like Stanford or MIT and be a great engineer. I wish I had the opportunity to go to Stanford, even though it doesn't have a formal entrepreneurship program. What you glean and kind of take away from courses like Dave's is unbelievable. And that's why the engineer / entrepreneurs coming out of Stanford are unbelievable talent. By the way, we're going to be at the Stanford Job Fair tomorrow.
So tell us a little bit more about that. So if people want to find out about the Stanford Job Fair.
They have an organization on campus called BASES. I don't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's essentially entrepreneurship. There's a BASES career fair, I think, tomorrow at Stanford. And if you search for BASES Stanford, I'm sure you'll find it.
I will find it. So continue on your thought because we don't have that much time left, and I want to make sure you get to finish your thought.
So in terms of dropping out, I definitely agree with a lot of the things that Dave said. Schools, the education system is broken in the sense that one size fits all is not right for everybody. I can tell you that I learned more in a month, or did learn more in a month when I was doing these companies over the last 13 years, than I would in a year of school when it comes to the types of skills that I wanted. School is great, and you can learn a lot from that, but what school has essentially become, the point of school, and teachers will tell you this, is that they're trying to teach you how to learn, not necessarily to teach you stuff that matters. They're trying to give you the hard skills so that you can go out and learn more and then get on the job training and so on. So it's kind of a cost-benefit case. So in my situation with iSocket, it spun out of my second business, which I was running while I was a student. I looked at iSocket. We started to get validation for it, and that's key. It wasn't just, oh, I want to drop out of school because I think that that's what I have to do to be a successful Silicon Valley CEO. I dropped out of school because we had validation that this idea was on the right track. We started to have even big people in the industry come to us and say, this is awesome. We want this. So that gave us the, I guess, the cojones to say, okay, it's time to leave. As you mentioned, I dropped out of school when I had 6 courses left on 2 degrees. So I was close to the end, but the timing was important, so we did it. If it was a situation where even if I knew I had a good idea, but there wasn't time pressure, in other words, I didn't need to do it right then, I wouldn't have dropped out. I would have finished. So don't get caught up in, I have to drop out to be like Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg. Look at your scenario, understand what you will get from college and what you won't, and then apply that to what you need. And if the timing is right, do it. If not, get your degree.
And that's probably the first really good business lesson, is if you can do a good cost benefit or whatever you want to call it, but some sort of analysis to compare the two and factor in timing as a major, major factor. That's so essential. There's no one size fits all, especially these days. I think that's really key coming out of this. And we're running a little bit over time, but I just want to make sure our people that heard about the career fair, since so many folks are looking these days, if you go to Faces, that's baseball-based, plural, .stanford.edu, and hit events. The Startup Career Fair is tomorrow, as John said, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time at the Sequoia Plaza Lawn at Stanford. So there's more information, of course, on their website, and we'll do some linking from JenniferNeelyLindsay.com as well, which you can access wherever you found the show. And John, since we're over time anyway, any parting thoughts?
Two. Thank you for putting me and Dave together. That was great. The second, for those who are listening who want to be an entrepreneur, they want to found a kind of your typical startup, I understand because I've been there. You want to find answers to these questions. You dig around and you read blog posts and you go to Ask a VC and Ben Horowitz's blog. Do that, but know that there is no golden rule. The only golden rule is that there are no other golden rules. You will find conflicting advice. There is no one-size-fits-all path. I mentioned earlier, if you're genuine, if you're in it for the right reasons, and you work hard and you're persistent, it'll work out. So don't get caught up in the minutia of, am I doing the exact right thing at every moment?
Perfect. And on that note, John Ramey of iSocket, which is the letter I, and then socket with a K. So do, I guess it's isocket.com, which is an advertising platform for publishers. And I guess non-publishers alike. It's something that it's such an interesting model that I encourage all of you to check it out, and especially from an entrepreneurial point of view, if you're interested in doing something that is solving something that maybe isn't super obvious to you, or is born out of born out of another company, as John's example illustrates. It's a great example of that. So, John, I applaud you for being kind of the typical good American success story, and wish you lots of luck. I hope you'll keep in touch with us and keep us posted on how you're doing, how the company's doing.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year to you as well. Again, that was John Ramey. And for more information on this program and others, you can go to JenniferNeelyLindsay.com, or you can find us here on Blog Talk Radio or on iTunes. And with that, I wish everyone a great day.